Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. On today's show, hear about a local assembly candidate who's been going to extremes to dodge debates, even disappearing when a fire alarm went off. Then, learn why a candidate in the El Cajon mayoral race has dropped out of the campaign to avoid being fired from his job. El Cajon Councilman Ben Colacio's problems continue to mount, with defaced signs, two new police reports filed against him, and other legal woes. On the Sounds of History today, we'll tell you about a flight aboard the Sentimental Journey, a World War II warbird plane, and share recollections from two 95-year-old pilots and prisoners of war. A Santee grandmother has been seriously injured when a tour bus in Africa overturned, and she needs financial help for a medical flight home. Hear how you can help on today's show. Plus, we'll have details on a worker killed by falling beams at a Spring Valley Ironworks facility. On our health report, learn about the disturbing spread of valley fever in California. And we have good news for ratepayers in the Padre Dam Water District, which has frozen your water rates. On People Power, find out about a food drive that the Mother Goose Parade and Waste Management are holding in El Cajon to help homeless people transitioning off the streets. And finally, we'll be re-airing our newsmakers interview today with Battalion Chief Mike Van Bibber from the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, along with firefighter paramedic Karen Kiefer and fire survivor Lori Foss on their fight to save our region's last volunteer fire district. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
James Zelaya, the Democratic nominee running for state assembly in the 71st Assembly District, has been clamoring to debate his opponent, incumbent Randy Vopel, a Republican. But Vopel has gone to extremes to dodge debates and candidate forums, even ducking out of the building when a fire alarm conveniently went off at a recent event where Vopel was slated to speak and spotted his opponent in the room. At a forum October 6th at Lantern Crest Senior Living in Santee, for local council candidates, organizers invited candidates for other offices, including Vopel, to speak to those present. "He saw me and immediately froze," says Elia. "I said there are people here. They want to hear us. Let's get this done." He walked away. Moments later, a fire alarm went off. Elia says he stayed to help seniors evacuate the theater. Minutes later, the alarm stopped and everyone went back inside, but not Vopel, who had vanished. It isn't the first time Vopel avoided appearing on stage with Elia, who has offered to debate Vopel any time, any place, in any format. Elia says he drove all the way to Idlewild in the mountains of Riverside County for a debate at which Vopel's staff had indicated Vopel or a staffer would show up. Later, staff said they might merely send answers to written questions, but when Elia arrived, Vopel was a no-show. There was no staffer, nor even written answers provided to the questions sent by event organizers, a progressive organization. "I said, okay, if he's not going to show up, I'll go to a conservative venue," says Elia, who then agreed to a debate at Meridian Baptist Church. But Vopel didn't show up for a debate at Meridian Baptist Church. Other groups, including the Elks Club and National Action Network, have sought to hold debates or candidate forums, but thus far, Vopel has not agreed to participate in any of them. Vopel did not respond to our message requesting comment for the story. However, during a fundraiser for Alpine Fire Survivors recently, Vopel spoke with ECM editor Miriam Raftery. Asked if any debates or forums were planned with his opponent, Vopel said he believed he could win without doing any debates or forums, and saw no reason to participate. Voters wishing to hear from both candidates on the issues may view that as a disservice to the public. By dodging debates, Vopel also deprives the public and the press the opportunity to ask about recent controversies, such as allegations raised by Larry Wilski, a retired Navy SEAL defeated in the primary who accused Vopel of stolen valor or inflating his military record. Elia has also filed a complaint with the Fair Political Practices Commission, alleging that Vopel violated campaign laws while Vopel was mayor of Santee. Campaign disclosure documents filed with the city show that Vopel failed to report starting and operating Copperhead Copper Trading Company. The business sold copper bars, cathodes, and bronze ingots. Vopel closed Copperhead Copper Trading Company when he launched his assembly run. The website has been scrubbed off the internet, but we have a copy. It includes an introduction authored by Vopel titled, Copper, the Poor Man's Gold, identifying himself as the mayor of Santee. It states, Copperhead Copper Trading Company LLC started out with a crime being committed in the year 2010. Vopel recalls how copper thieves stole thousands of dollars in copper wiring from a park and ball field in Santee that proved costly to replace, then states, Observant fellow that I started thinking about how people were risking their lives through electrocution, falling, and other injuries to get their hands on that shiny metal. I thought to myself, that copper stuff must be valuable. I want some. On the website, he states that after a four-month search for affordable copper, he started the company, stating that he found an honest supplier to sell him copper in $20,000 chunks, which he offered to resell as a commodity for investors seeking an alternative to gold and silver. It remains unclear why Vopel didn't disclose the business on his campaign finance filings, or why his military records don't fully support his claims about his service, such as his taped remarks about fighting in the jungles of Vietnam, when records show he was a sailor aboard a ship offshore at the time. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
Robert Weaver, a Navy veteran now working for an acquisition agency for the U.S. Navy, has been forced to withdraw from the El Cajon mayoral race in order to keep his job. In an email to East County Magazine, Weaver says the U.S. Office of Special Counsel has determined that the El Cajon mayoral race is partisan. He adds, This ruling means that I am in violation of the Hatch Act, and I must choose between my candidacy and my government job. I have elected to resign my candidacy. The Hatch Act, passed in 1939, prohibits civilians working for the federal executive branch, including the Department of Defense, from running for partisan offices or engaging in certain other political activities, but it allows them to run for nonpartisan offices. The law was intended to prevent federal employees from intimidating or influencing others. Weaver works at the Space and Warfare Naval Systems Command, or SPAWAR, in systems acquisition, where he says he does not supervise anybody. In an interview with the San Diego Union-Tribune, he said of the ruling, I think they've taken a very harsh reading of the law, and I would like to see that overturned. And he provided a copy of the opinion issued by the U.S. Office of Special Counsel as evidence. Mayoral positions are considered nonpartisan under California law, since candidates do not run to represent a political party and no primary races are held. Moreover, Weaver is not a member of any political party. However, the U.S. Office of Special Counsel found that this race is partisan because one of the other two candidates, incumbent Mayor Bill Wells, has been endorsed by the Republican Party and his name will appear on a mailer sent by the party. Now it's too late for Weaver's name to be removed from the ballot. In addition to Mayor Wells, Joel Scalziti, a Helix Water Board member who is also a Republican, is in the race. The Special Counsel's broad interpretation of the term partisan is troubling, because it could preclude many federal workers from running for virtually any office if any other candidate in a race receives an endorsement from a political party. The ruling is also problematic because a candidate has no way of knowing when entering a nonpartisan race whether an opponent may seek or receive a partisan endorsement, and withdrawing late in the race means some voters cast ballots for the candidate not realizing that he or she has withdrawn. Not making a decision on whether a candidacy violates the Hatch Act until a month before an election, as the U.S. Council did here, could also deprive a candidate the opportunity to have time to mount a viable campaign even if a race were ruled nonpartisan and the campaign was allowed to go forward. In a region such as San Diego, with many civilians employed in the defense industry, the special counsel's interpretation could preclude a large number of people from pursuing political office. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
El Cajon Councilman Ben Colasso is claiming that 53 of his signs have been defaced, alternatively blaming his Republican opponent and left-wing forces. In a video on his Facebook page, Colasso states, That's over $5,000 in damage by my opponent. Later, he says, It's sad that we live in a time when Marxists and fascists are taking over our American values, adding, "We will not allow these terrorists to interfere with our elections." Colosho's opponent, Councilman Gary Kendrick, has denied that his campaign defaced any Colosho signs. Kendrick has held office for 20 years and has never been accused of sign tampering in any of his prior campaigns. Colosho's video states, "I've never seen anything like this." But, in fact, he has, in all three of his prior races. In 2016, when he was elected to the El Cajon Council, Colosho claimed that 62 of his campaign signs were stolen or defaced. He posted surveillance video showing two purported thieves, whom he said he reported to police. Back then, Colosho said he believed he was targeted by Middle Eastern residents who opposed his support for limiting the influx of refugees into El Cajon. In his unsuccessful 2012 run for the council, Colosho accused a campaign worker for his opponent, Bill Wells, of stealing his campaign signs and replacing them with signs backing Wells. Colosho campaign workers did state they saw signs being stolen. Back in 2010, when Colosho lived in Santee and ran for Santee's city council, a campaign sign was marked with racist graffiti. Jimmy Green told CBS News that Colosho's sign was defaced with the words, "The Arab leader Santee needs." Green told CBS 8 he reported the damage to Colosho, adding that Colosho told him, "The funny thing is, I'm Polish." In fact, Colosho is an Iraqi immigrant of Chaldean descent. Stealing or damaging signs is a crime. While it's unclear just who defaced Colosho's signs in this election, a list of possible suspects might read like the cast of a whodunit novel. Many people have animosity toward Colosho, who has a long string of ethical and legal challenges. Those include civil lawsuits, including a pending suit claiming he sexually harassed beauty pageant contestants and cyber-stalked them, also defaming a lawyer and a taco shop owner. He's pled guilty to workers' compensation fraud, had a jury find him guilty in a business fraud case, more recently had two police incident reports filed by people alleging he threatened them with an attack dog, and had a third police report of stalking filed by Kendrick's son. Colosho also had a phony charity shut down by the state, unsuccessfully sued El Cajon alleging discrimination, and has lashed out to mock citizens who spoke against him at council meetings, where many called for his resignation. In addition, two websites dedicated to exposing Colosho's troubled history have popped up online, Transparent East County and the Ben Colosho Free Speech Clown Appreciation Project. Colosho has responded to the recent defamation of his campaign signs by adding a new message at the top in red. It reads, "My opponent wants to limit your free speech by defacing my signs. We fought wars against this exact behavior. God bless America. Vote to protect our freedoms." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show, and now it's time for the Sounds of History.
They call them the Greatest Generation, and on October 1st, World War II veteran pilots reminisced about their combat flight experiences aboard a B-17 Warbird aptly named Sentimental Journey. This peacetime flight out of El Cajon's Gillespie Field was offered by the Arizona Memorial Museum's staff and flight crew to local members of the press and public, and our reporter, Rebecca Jeffress Williamson, was on board. 95-year-old Bill Milton recalls, "I was on my 11th mission when I got shot down on a strafing run in Greece. I was coming in low to see if I could hit as many airplanes and buildings as possible, trying to hinder their ability to operate off their airfield." Milton was captured and became a prisoner of war, or POW. He was transferred from Greece to Stalagluft III in Germany, where he was imprisoned for 7 months. "Food was scarce," he recalls. "You were living in conditions where you were guarded all the time," continued Milton. Then General Patton reached the area with Allied troops, and Milton was rescued in April 1945. Fellow World War II pilot Ed Davidson, now 95, was a pilot on a B-17 when he was 19 years old. He recalls, "Everything happened in a couple of seconds. We were flying very low to the ground. Then ground fire took out my left engine. He too became a POW when he was shot down over occupied France on his seventh mission in January 1944. The next day we went through Paris, and then to Frankfurt, then to Barth, says Davison, who spent 16 months in Stalag Luft I. I spent my 21st birthday there, he recalls. In April, we started hearing the guns, so by May 1st, 1945, the Russians liberated us. They put 30 POWs on each B-17 and flew them to Allied military camps. We were at Camp Lucky Strike, he says, adding that each of the camps were named for cigarette brands. Debbie English is the adjutant and membership officer for Air Group 1, based out of Gillespie Field. She and her husband, Doug, were both on hand to greet the crew of the Sentimental Journey. She says they worked for 6 months to get the Arizona Commemorative Air Force Museum crew here, along with the Sentimental Journey B-17. Air Group 1 was formed as the San Diego Squadron of CAF in 1981. They were renamed Air Group 1 2 years later. They have a hangar and a World War II museum, with a mission to keep history alive by restoring World War II aircraft, providing memorial flyovers at events, and a presence at local air shows. The organization brought the Sentimental Journey to the airport and offered rides for a fee in the rare B-17G Warbird, one of only 8 of this model left in the entire world. During the 25-minute air tour over East County, the roar of the engine, images of the propeller and the sky beyond induced an adrenaline rush and a sense of what it must have been like riding in this aircraft during wartime. But on this flight, passengers didn't have to fear being shot down by enemy aircraft or taken prisoner. As the Sentimental Journey landed, veteran Bill Milton called it a beautiful flight. If you would like to take a ride aboard the Sentimental Journey, the vintage airplane will be in Palm Springs until October 14th and in Bakersfield until October 21st. For more information or to purchase a ride, you can visit flyinglegendstour.com. To find out about future flight opportunities or to support Air Group 1, you can visit the Air Group 1 website at ag1caf.org. Reporting for East County Magazine's Sounds of History series, this is John Fistier.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Jeanette Craig, a retiree and grandmother from Santee, has been seriously injured while vacationing in Lesotho, an African nation, where a tour bus overturned. 3 people were killed and 12 were injured. Craig suffered a fractured pelvis and leg, as well as torn ligaments. Her friend Nicholas Wiseman says regular airlines will not transport her because of the severity of her injuries. The cost of the flight is estimated at $160,000. While Jeanette has travel insurance, it will not cover those costs. Insurance covered only a helicopter flight to a clinic near Lesotho, where she has undergone several surgeries. Her family wants to bring her back to San Diego to undergo an MRI and other tests, but because of her condition, she can only travel lying down on a specially equipped medical airplane. Wiseman has started a GoFundMe page to help Jeanette Craig return home. The site includes a video made by Jeanette from her hospital bed where she tearfully describes her intense pain. Her daughter-in-law, Tamira Baca Craig, told 10 News that her mother is suffering severe breakthrough pain every time she shifts because her pelvis is bone on bone. Stephanie Young, a family friend, posted on Facebook, "We never know when adventure is going to take a wrong turn." She urges travelers to check on their travel insurance coverage and urges the community to please donate to help bring Jeanette Craig home. Jeanette's daughter, Kylie, has flown to South Africa to be with her mother, leaving her job and family, and that's put a financial strain on her household, too. You can make a donation to help Jeanette Craig come home at the Jeanette Craig Emergency page on GoFundMe.com. Reporting for EastCountyMagazine.org, this is Miriam Raftery.
A worker crushed by iron beams last week at a Spring Valley metal fabrication yard has been identified as 29-year-old Gregorio Segundo, the county medical examiner's office reports. Segundo was helping to load I-beams onto a truck at West Coast Iron on Hamishaw Road on October 3rd when the tragedy occurred. A beam being lifted by a forklift operated by another worker hit a stack of beams, causing three to fall off the trailer and strike Segundo, who was knocked to the ground. Segundo had no pulse when paramedics and deputies arrived at the scene. Paramedics restored his pulse before taking him to Scripps Mercy Hospital, but the doctors at the emergency room were unable to revive him, and he was pronounced dead of blunt force trauma at the hospital trauma bay. California's Division of the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, Cal OSHA, will investigate to determine whether any workplace violations may have occurred. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is John Fister with a health report. Valley fever is on the rise in California. This year may be the worst ever, and climate change is contributing to spread the potentially deadly virus, CalMatters reports. In 2016, California had more than 6,000 valley fever cases reported. In 2017, that number jumped by more than a third to over 8,100 cases. Valley fever season starts this month. Most cases surface between September and November, but through August this year, more than 5,000 cases have already been reported in California, putting the state on a pace for a new record. Ian McCarty, co-director of the Center for Valley Fever at the University of California, Davis, says the increase in cases over the last 2 years is striking. It's a catastrophic change, he says, and it's getting worse. The fungus typically infects the lungs after spores are inhaled, producing a persistent cough and chest pain or other flu-like symptoms that can require months of treatment. It can be hard to diagnose because it can mimic those of other ailments, and in many people, symptoms fade away on their own. But in other patients, it spreads. Rob Purdy caught valley fever back in 2012 from an airborne soil fungus that gave him meningitis, a swelling of the membranes lining the brain and spinal cord. Pain in his head has been intense. Purdy has a reservoir surgically built into his skull and must spend one full day each month with antifungal drugs pumping directly into his brain. It sounds horrible, and it is, Purdy says, yet considers himself lucky to be alive. Governor Jerry Brown this month signed three bills into law to help combat valley fever. The current state budget includes $8 million for research and education to keep more Californians from catching the infection and improve diagnosis so that symptoms can be treated accurately. But despite the state response, experts say the disease likely will continue to expand, with more people getting it in more areas of the state. One big reason, McCarty said, is climate change. A growing number of dust storms in California have spread the fungal spores far beyond the Central Valley, where the infections traditionally have been concentrated. McCarty says, we know there is a direct correlation between these dust storms and valley fever, and we know climate change is increasing the extreme weather patterns here, including the dust storms, he said. Valley fever is no longer strictly a valley phenomenon. It has become more common across the state, even in coastal areas. That has people concerned in places like Lakeside's El Monte Valley, where a sand mine is proposed. Valley fever spores are known to exist in the valley, where some local residents say they have contracted the disease. Disrupting the soils through mining could spread valley fever spores into the air and sicken residents. Potentially, sand contaminated with valley fever could be spread to other locations, where the sand would be used for roadway construction. Democratic Assemblyman Rudy Salas, Jr., wrote the three valley fever bills the governor signed. He says the infection has been reported in 53 of California's 58 counties, and he has family members and friends who have contracted it. The state's health care costs have spiraled higher with the increase in infection, he notes. Because valley fever can resemble the flu, many physicians outside of the Central Valley don't consider it in their diagnoses, even though the blood test to identify it is inexpensive and simple. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated there are about 150,000 undiagnosed cases a year, and McCarty says he thinks the number is higher. The most dangerous manifestation is meningitis, he said, and by the time patients go to the hospital, it's too late, so many people may die without ever being diagnosed, McCarty suspects. The California Department of Public Health doesn't regularly track deaths from valley fever, but it did compile statistics in one study. Officials concluded that 1,098 people died of the disease in California from 2000 to 2013, averaging about 73 deaths a year statewide. But fortunately, early diagnosis and treatment can save many patients.
This is Miriam Raftery with some good news for ratepayers in the Padre Dam Municipal Water District. The district directors have unanimously approved freezing water rates for fiscal year 2019. Board President Bill Pomring says we have a unique opportunity this year to provide some rate relief to our customers while still achieving all of the district's goals. Our water operation fund balances are strong due to higher than budgeted water sales last year, making the choice to forgo a previously approved water rate increase for this year the best decision for our customers, he says. A water rate hike had previously been approved as part of the district's five-year business plan and budget, but a rebound in water sales after the drought, including water sales for new housing developments and a new agreement signed with Sequan, have changed that outlook. A new analysis shows the increase in water sales will offset any losses of revenues from not raising rates. The Padre Dam Water District serves 100,000 residents in East County communities, including Santee, El Cajon, Lakeside, Flint Springs, Harbison Canyon, Blossom Valley, Alpine, Dehesa, and Crest.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
For the second consecutive year, Waste Management of San Diego and the Mother Goose Parade Association have launched a non-perishable food drive benefiting the East County Transitional Living Center. The drive will run from October 5th through November 16th and will culminate with food being collected at the Mother Goose Parade on November 18th. Christine Costa, a representative from Waste Management, says giving back to our local community is at the heart of our local waste management. We are grateful to be a part of the East County business community, and together we look forward to helping families in need, especially during the holidays. With the help of the community, Waste Management will present the non-perishable food donations to the East County Transitional Living Center in El Cajon, which helps homeless people transition off the streets. Community members can participate by dropping off non-perishable food items during business hours at the East County Chamber of Commerce office, or at the First Citizens Bank on West Main, or at Waste Management's headquarters in El Cajon. You can also bring items to the Mother Goose Parade, which rolls out starting at 1 p.m. on Sunday, November 18th in downtown El Cajon. To learn more about the Mother Goose Parade, you can visit mothergooseparade.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, my very special guests are Karen Kiefer. She is a firefighter paramedic with the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, and was the Emergency Medical Services Director with them for a long time. We also have with us Mike Van Bibber, who is the Battalion Chief for the Volunteer Fire District up there, and Lori Foss, who is here to talk about her experiences as a citizen of Julian with the Volunteer Fire Department. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Miriam, and thank you for having us here. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to the good folks of the East County. I just wanted to also mention on this historic day 17 years ago, let's honor all firefighters of this great country and the sacrifices that they've made.
Absolutely. So I should mention we're taping this on 9/11, so very appropriate to be talking about fire and life safety issues here. Listeners, we're here today to talk about the battle to save Julian's all-volunteer fire department, the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District. For those of you that are not familiar on the history of this, the county, as many of you know, after the big fires, the 2003 and 2007 fires, they got a lot of criticism for not having a county fire department. And so they started one, and they've now been going around and basically consolidating rural fire districts and getting rid of the volunteer fire departments around the county. Julian is the last remaining volunteer fire department, and many of its residents do not want to be taken over. Although the idea of a county fire department sounds good in principle, there have been some problems in the Julian Cuyamaca area resulting from some of this. And so we're here today to talk about these issues. Now, the status on this right now, as I understand this, is that earlier this month, LAFCO, the Local Agency Formation Commission, voted unanimously to dissolve the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Department, despite the fact that some 40 residents or so from Julian showed up, and all but two of them spoke against dissolving their district. They want to keep their volunteers. There's a process for stopping the LAFCO decision. Can you explain how that works?
Yes, ma'am. So there is a process. The people will have the opportunity to have their voices heard once the notifications have gone out to the public from LAFCO, which should be in the next day or so. We can collect, we meaning the citizens of Julian and Cuyamaca, can collect signatures of petition to voice their opinion to stop the, to force the LAFCO to put it to a vote of the citizens. That's all the community is really asking. It took a vote of the citizenry back in 1983 to form JCFPD, and it should take a vote of the community to dissolve it. So far, overwhelmingly, the community has spoken out. This started back, you mentioned when it began, it started in our community about 2013 when this county came knocking at our door. The community has spoken out many times since 2013 to retain our autonomy.
What percentage of the people voted initially to form this fire district?
Well, it took at least two-thirds of the community's voters, and my understanding, I was just a wee lad at the time, but it was overwhelming landslide. Over 80-some percent of the constituency here voted to approve the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District formation.
80%. So my understanding is that in order for the voters up there or the residents to block the LAFCO decision to keep their fire department independent and put it to a vote of the people, they would need to get signatures before the October 16th public hearing on this, public protest hearing that's scheduled. They would need to get 25% of the registered voters. There's about 2,400 voters up there. Or they would need to get 25% of the property owners to sign a petition. So is it my understanding you're going to have two petitions circulating up there for people to sign?
You know, that's highly possible. There is a group of citizens that are really working diligently. I call it the army, if you will, going out, and they're going to petition the community to gather those signatures. I'm not sure really what their strategy is, but most likely it will be twofold, like you're discussing, because LAFCO has laid out a couple different places or methods of us obtaining that 25%.
Okay. And I understand there's also a way that you could just block the takeover completely without it having to go to a vote. Tell us about that option.
Well, that option is in the same process, but we need to collect 50% of the registered voters and or landowners. And the 50%, according to LAFCO themselves, the XO's Keen Simons stated that 50% would cease the process completely. LAFCO would drop it and we would remain independent.
Okay. Now, that sounds like a high bar to reach, 25%, let alone 50. But on the other hand, you recently had signatures gathered to put another initiative on the ballot that is going on in November that would increase the fire fee to fund keeping the district independent, or to increase the funding for it to stay independent, because the county has said that if you don't join the county fire authority, we're cutting you off, we're going to take away all of your money, and basically you're on your own. What percentage of the people did you get to sign the petition to increase the fire fee?
So there's been several petitions. The one you're referring to, We received over 300 signatures from community members to get that onto the ballot. It went through the registrar process. The signatures were certified by the registrar, and it will be on the November ballot. It will be listed as Proposition QQ. Mm-hmm. And just historically, the Julian Quemaca Fire Protection District voted in a benefit fee, voted. The community was had a voice in this to assess themselves $50 per parcel back in 1984. Our department's been good stewards of that money ever since, and are still collecting just the $50. So the question is, can you continue to run your own household on a 1984 budget? It's time to move forward and step up. You're looking at pennies a day, really. It's $16 some change per month to bring the benefit fee to $200 annually for our residents.
Yeah. So the million-dollar question I'm sure a lot of listeners out there not familiar with this are asking is, why would you not want CAL FIRE to take over the fire services? The arguments that the county has put forward is it's going to be professionally trained firefighters, everybody's going to be safer, we're going to have better staffing for you. Karen, can you talk a little about the reality of how that promise has lived up to the reality that you've seen, given that you've handled these dispatch records for both the volunteers and, you know, the CAL FIRE calls that have come in through the years?
Well, the concern I'm seeing is what they call the standard of cover. With that, they have what's called a move up in cover with their county engines. And the county engines are responsible for structure protection, EMS, traffic collisions. With the standard of cover and the move up in cover, the county will move engines around to higher populated areas because each community is ranked by population density, business, and the roads and different situations like that. And the lower ranking communities are going to be the last on the list, and they're going to be virtually sometimes left uncovered for EMS and traffic collisions.
Now, we've already seen some stations closed, dark days. I guess, I mean, that's happened before and after, but if you're out in Ranchita or somewhere and you have an emergency, good luck, because there's a lot of days where nobody's there. So you're saying they haven't lived up to that promise of getting these stations staffed and getting rid of dark days.
Absolutely. From my understanding is Ranchita, Deluse, and San Pasqual are all reserve stations, so they're not considered a county station. With county stations, to have the career firefighters with the county engine on them, but the reserve stations might have a patrol, a water tender, where they can maybe jump off the patrol, jump on the water tender to a wildland fire or something like that. They may or not be covered. Ranchita, the month of June of this year, was covered 6 days, and that's all. They're lucky
and
to get.
This is after the takeover by the county began, and they've started this rollout already. So you're saying 6 days covered, that means there were, what, 24 days in June where there was nobody at all at that station?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Chief Van Bibber, I understand that there have already been some issues on responses to some incidents, including a fire in January. Tell us about that.
Miriam, there's been several fires within our county here just this summer. What a lot of folks don't understand is that CAL FIRE through San Diego County Fire Authority occupied our station June 1st. So their responsibility became Julian and Cuyamaca. With the wildfires created throughout the county and the resources being spread thin because of other fires places elsewhere, our engine from Julian, the county CAL FIRE engine, went on several occasions off the mountain to assist in that suppression effort. The downside is it left Julian and Cuyamaca uncovered for an extended period of time. That's where the Julian Cuyamaca Volunteer Fire Department is important. We are the home team. We don't leave. We stay and we cover when the others are gone. It's been that way for 35 years. CAL FIRE and JCFPD have had a great working relationship for many years. They helped us. We helped them. I put together a list of incidents since 2000 or so where CAL FIRE was either off the mountain or tied up on another incident, and it was JCFPD that made the difference.
Yeah, I've got a list of some of those incidences. And by the way, we have certainly asked CAL FIRE to respond about these, and if we get a response, we'll be glad to share it. But I understand there was a case where a house burned to the ground in Shelter Valley because CAL FIRE was out of the service area. In another case, a resident in Ranchita says he watched his neighbor's house burn to the ground while CAL FIRE's crew drove back and forth looking for it. Getting lost on these backcountry roads is a real issue, and I think that's one area where the volunteers definitely have the advantage because they live there and they know the area. There was a Pine Hills case, we're told, where a mother, a woman, nearly died when CAL FIRE couldn't find the home, not once, but twice. And at Camp Marston in July of 2017, when there was a camp for children with cancer, CAL FIRE reportedly canceled a response on a call for a child that needed to be flown out by air medical ambulance, and the driver communicated to the family that they could not find them. Now, I understand Chief Meacham has denied this one, but we, you know, we've seen an email that says CAL FIRE had difficulty finding the location, so they do kind of acknowledge that. Lori, I understand you've had a personal situation where I think it really shows the importance of having firefighters right there in the community all the time and not having them come for 20 or 30 minutes or maybe even farther away. Tell us your story.
There were two instances. One was the 2003 Cedar Fire, where they made sure everyone was out of Harrison Park. That was the backfire that CAL FIRE lit that burned my home and 150 others.
A backfire lit by CAL FIRE burned 150 homes?
Yes, it did.
Oh, my goodness. So you lost your house in that fire.
Mm-hmm.
And you nearly lost it a second time. What happened?
Well, in the 2007 witch fire, we had, it was my daughter and I alone in the house. And her school teacher noticed that she had not been at school. And because of the winds being so high and no electricity, no cell phone coverage whatsoever, all the towers were out, we were the last in the entire town to be evacuated. We had four horses with us, and I had my daughter, and they came and found us, and it was almost 6 o'clock at night in October, and it was dark. The embers were everywhere.
Terrifying.
It was. The tree had fallen on the horse trailer. We couldn't get the horses out in the horse trailer. So we ended up tying the horses to the minivan, and they helped us get the horses tied to the minivan. They told us if we went out, we could not come back for the horses. So we had to get them all at once. Loaded the dogs in the car, loaded the cats in the carrier, and they took us to the high school where there's cement everywhere.
Wow. And how close was the fire to your house at this point?
My roof was on fire.
Your roof was on fire. So the volunteer firefighters got you and all your animals out when the roof was on fire.
And you've told me that the volunteer firefighters also saved your house from burning down, prevented you from losing your home a second time to fire.
Yes. What do you think would have happened if they were coming from 30 minutes away?
We didn't know which way to go. The embers were flying everywhere. One of the, David Southcott, the captain of the Julian Volunteers, came with a water truck and shone a light on, behind us so we could see ahead of us because it was just almost impossible. Mm-hmm. And without the lights from the water tender behind us, we would not have made it.
Wow. Now, I know that CAL FIRE has sometimes responded to fires in the past, even before the takeover. And Karen, you've provided some troubling data to us where CAL FIRE was trying to show the county what their response times had been historically, and you found some things that were left off. You've sent me some data here from between April and June 2017, and by my count, there are at least six calls on here where it took CAL FIRE between 25 and 30 minutes to arrive. But there may have been some issues of, you know, which dispatch they were getting it from and so forth, but it certainly shows that there's been at least some calls where the response time was pretty long. As an emergency medical responder, a paramedic, how critical is it? What's considered an industry standard for how long is too long to get there on a medical emergency response call?
Well, if you're having a cardiac arrest or you're bleeding to death, minutes count. Within 5 minutes, 5 to 6 minutes, you can have brain death if you're not breathing. It's clinically dead.
So if I'm a tourist and I'm choking on my apple pie in Julian, and it takes 20 or 30 minutes for an engine to get there?
Yes, that would be very bad. I mean, it would have a very poor outcome And the concern that I have personally with knowing what's happening with the standards of cover and the move up and cover with the engines being moved, the county engines being moved to higher populated areas, such as in Witch Creek that covers Intermountain Station, is often called into the city of Ramona and sits in Station 80 and waits for calls there because the volume is higher and population's higher, leaving the entire corridor, 16-mile corridor of Highway 78 from outskirts of Ramona all the way to Santa Isabel, uncovered completely.
Yeah, we should mention that of those six calls I just referenced, all of them were in Julian, and three of them were on Highway 78 there. So this is a very heavily traveled tourist corridor, and have you seen any improvement at all in coverage for that area since CAL FIRE began its official takeover? Has it been the same, better, or worse?
Yes, Miriam. First of all, I'd like to clarify, people do not choke on Julian pie. secondarily, you'd hope that there'd be a difference in coverage. And right now, you still have two agencies working in conjunction with each other. So we have the ability to make those differences in cover for each other in the event that we're tied up on another call or in another district. With the JCFPD being removed completely, you won't have that coverage any longer. They're going to be reliant on their own system and nobody else. And, you do the math. You drive from Ramona to Julian. How long does that take? And you're driving a big truck in the event of a fire. It takes even longer. So we have agencies around us, but they're at a distance. Shelter Valley is going to be 25, 30-minute response time. Ramona is going to be 25, 30-minute response time. That's unacceptable. I get it that the movement is to take care of the larger populated areas. But if you live out in the East County with us, that's not fair to us.
Yeah.
We deserve the same thing as anybody else.
Sure. Everybody's paying taxes, whether you're in Ranchita or,
Absolutely.
Somewhere else. Did you have something to add, Karen?
Yeah. About a couple months ago, we had a call in Highway 78. The location of the call was at Santa Isabel, right in front of Don's Market. It was a vehicle into a tree. The closest resource for the county was coming from the city of Ramona because Engine 85 in Witch Creek was gone, and it had capability for extrication. And that's the concern we have, is the distance, how that's pretty far away. Unfortunately, at the time, during that time, through the politics, Santa Isabel was not allowed to respond off of reservation. They're minutes away and they had, extrication equipment. Wow. It was denied that they couldn't respond through CAL FIRE dispatch.
Lori, I understand that you have some of this exchange on tape from dispatch. Could we hear it, please?
Not this particular one, but for another medical call when state mutual aid is guaranteed. And CAL FIRE's Monta Vista dispatch denied medical aid for the ambulance, even though they're supposed to respond it when it's requested specifically. And it was a medical emergency.
Let's hear it.
Okay, and that was Karen was driving, or you were in the ambulance at that time, Karen?
Yes.
And here it is.
Start responding San Isabel Fire, closest resource for state mutual aid, please.
And that was the end of that tape, and they did not respond them to that medical aid.
Very troubling. Now, listeners, for those of you who may have just tuned in, we're speaking with some folks from Julian about their effort to stop the county takeover of the Julian Fire District, Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District. And to do that, they need to get signatures on a petition by people in the district, either registered voters or property owners, and if they can get 25% of either, then it goes on the ballot. If they can get 50%, it would block it outright. So it begs the question of, if you're successful in this and you do block the takeover, what plans do you have going forward, Chief Van Bibber, to make sure that you can provide, I guess, a better level of service than what we're hearing from what you're seeing with CAL FIRE?
Okay, Miriam, there's several things in motion right now. One of them, you mentioned the ballot initiative that's coming up. On that same time, on the ballot will be two board seats for the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District Board. Their seats are up, and three candidates from our community have gone through the registrar process and are candidates to take those two seats.
Now, can you tell us who these three candidates that are running are, and what is their position on keeping the district independent versus having it taken over by CAL FIRE? That seems to be the burning question, so to speak.
Yeah, there's three candidates, as I mentioned. Mike McGinney is one, Patricia Landis is another, and Eva Hatch. Those are the three candidates. All three of them have stated that they want to be supportive of Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, and right now we just need a couple more swing votes to put it back the ball in our court. Right now we have a deficit of board members that are bent on removing us from service, and the majority of the community, the constituency that's going to vote these folks into place, they're listening to those folks, and they want to keep us solvent.
I want to say that, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, we certainly honor and respect all of our firefighters. And I know here at East County Magazine, we run the East County Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. We know that both the volunteer firefighters and CAL FIRE, you know, when they're at a fire, they're certainly risking their lives every day, whether they're fighting a wildland fire or a structure fire. And they're there for the, you know, those medical alerts too, which is so important. But that said, it seems to me it's a shame that we can't have the best of both worlds. Chief Van Bibber, you were talking before the show a little bit, likening this situation a bit to, you know, the military. Can you tell us that analogy?
Yes. I was speaking to one of our residents here a couple months back, older gentleman, probably in his early 70s, and he had a baseball cap on that said United States Army. So I thanked him for his service. I always make an effort to thank the veterans of our country, and he thanked me for my service, and he said, you know, I've been thinking about you guys. He meant to he was referring to the volunteer firefighters. As a resident of Julian, he's been hearing all the rhetoric that's going on, the propaganda, and the reasons pro and con to keep us around. And his statement to me was, he said, it dawned on me that you guys are like the National Guard. He was an Army regular. He did 20 years of service to our country. And he said, while I was in service, he said, I did not like the National Guard. They were the weekend warriors, if you were. We were the professional paid soldiers. We were the ones going overseas and doing the job. And these guys got to stay at home and only practice on weekends. He said, then it dawned on me on an overseas deployment, who's watching the home front? Who's protecting my home? And he said it was the National Guard. He said, my respect for them grew immediately. You guys, Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, is the National Guard of Julian. We're there to stand at the home front when the problems arise.
Yeah, so it begs the question of, why would the county not want to allow Julian to keep its volunteer fire department, if people feel strongly about that, and still have, as they've done in the past, have CAL FIRE available, you know, maybe as the first responder, or maybe as, you know, backup when the volunteers aren't available, they're all out on calls. But why would you not want that backup of having the volunteers at least still around, so that if CAL FIRE guys are out fighting a wildland fire somewhere, or they're just coming from far away, it's the middle of night and there's a medical emergency, letting the guys, you know, who are closest in be able to respond? It just doesn't seem, there seems to be a logic that's escaping me at the moment on that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of theories out there and opinions, and I have one, but I'm going to keep it to myself. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you is that since the inception of San Diego County Fire Authority in 2008, this county has lost over 400 firefighters.
Boots
on the ground. Yes, ma'am. Boots on the ground, volunteer firefighters that were there protecting their home front. They're gone. They've been absorbed, dismissed, whatever. That's sad. And our current events that are going on, there's more wildfire. They're bigger. They're more intense than ever. Call it global warming. Call it what you want, but it's facts. You can see it on the evening news every night. We need, as a county, more firefighters, not less. If the JCFPD is taken down, this county is going to lose another additional 50 firefighters that are trained to go and help in a time of need.
I really want to thank all of you for taking the time to drive
all the way down from Julian today to be on our show. And certainly if anyone from Cal Fire or County Fire Authority is listening and you want to come on the show too and tell us your side of this story, we would love to hear it. I'm going to give each of you a moment here to share any final thoughts that you might have with our listeners about this situation.
Well, just to clarify, Miriam, and thank you again for the opportunity to be here today. You know, all firefighters are valuable. It doesn't matter what patch we wear, what color shirt we wear. It's the willingness and the abilities to serve our fellow man. And so we need all of us, not just a limited few, not just one team. We need multiple teams playing at this. And that's with any jurisdiction, any place in this country. No one department can stand alone and do it all by themselves. I don't care how big you are. So I just appreciate all firefighters. I'm glad that we are here still serving our community, and I look forward to many more years of service to the communities of Julian and Cuyamaca.
Very good. What about you, Karen?
Thank you, Miriam, for having us on today. I started my career out in 1995 with a volunteer department. And when I came to California, and then a few years later, I became employed with Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District in 2003. And I've had the honor to work with volunteers. Our department has put out so many amazing young men and women. Like Chief Ambetter and I were talking earlier today, many of those people are chiefs in other departments.
So they've had professional training. These aren't
Yes. And I've had two partners. One right now is had a conditional offer to go to LA, a city fire department. And the other one was hired for LA City Department. We put out very professional people. And it's been my honor to work with volunteers. I love them. And they're just wonderful.
Very good. And Lori, how about you?
With Cal Fire, their mission statement is wildland fire. With Julian, the mission statement is structure, medical, and vehicle accidents. And we need both in Julian. We need to vote to keep our volunteers, but we need both. We love the boots on the ground. As a civilian, I can say I'm not very happy with Cal Fire's administration and their practices. In my opinion, the deception that I've witnessed personally. But as far as the boots on the ground, this doesn't go down to them. We appreciate them. We love them. And we want to work with the Cal Fire boots on the ground. But we want our independent Julian volunteer fire station too. We don't want that to go away, and we're going to vote to keep it. I can tell you 83% right now are in favor of keeping the Julian volunteer fire department. That's 5-1.
Is there anything that people listening out there who may not live in Julian, but, you know, like many of us, like me, enjoy going up there, enjoying the apple pie, the fall season, the shops. You know, it is a very popular tourist destination, both for locals and people from out of the area. Is there anything that non-Julian residents can do if they are interested in helping your effort, or a place they can go to if they want to learn more about this?
So first of all, you can talk to your area representatives. For our area, it's Diane Jacobs. There's other representatives throughout the county. You can talk to them. It's not just Julian and Cuyamaca that's affected. It's going to be the entire unincorporated area of the county. Our Board of Supervisors, and then you can take it to the next level too. Write letters. Just be vocal. The voice of the people will be heard. And that's important to know that the democracy of our country is built on that very thing. So don't be shy. You can talk to these folks. Let them know what you feel. As far as coming and visiting to our great place, it's still open. It's still running great. The pies are wonderful. Come visit. The snow's coming this season. So come and enjoy Julian. It's a great place to live, great place to recreate, and wonderful place to visit.
Very good. I want to thank all of you for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.